Your North Carolina Reading Service presents this program for our blind and print-impaired listeners. And it's the Indie Week. This issue, dated February the 2nd, 2022. And John Federson here, and all dressed up in my tropical short sleeves due to our very, very warm temperatures today in February in Raleigh. And enjoying our theme music, performed by the Island Ska Invaders Steel Drum Ensemble. And I have to finish today before the limbo contest begins shortly, and so I better get to it. We'll skip the op-ed for right now and get on to Jane Porter's column from Wake County News, Ethics Questions. In her nearly a decade in office, Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman hasn't earned a reputation for taking a hard line against cops who abuse their power. She could have had her chance to show she's tough on bad apple officers in the case of a former Granville County Sheriff's Deputy, Chad Coffey, the one-time head of that county's drug unit, whom Freeman is prosecuting on numerous felony charges related to embezzlement, a drug conspiracy, and obstructing justice. That is, if Freeman hasn't jeopardized the case by behaving unethically herself. In a motion filed last week, Coffey's attorneys are asking a state court to dismiss the case against their client, following what they characterize as Freeman's being subject to, quote, influences that undermine confidence that a prosecution can be conducted in disinterested fashion, per that motion. Coffey faces 11 felony charges in Granville County for obstructing justice, conspiring to deliver cocaine and embezzlement, plus another 24 charges in Wake County relating to falsifying training documents and qualification requirements for a former Granville County sheriff and a former chief deputy between 2013 and 2018. Freeman took up the case against Coffey after Granville County District Attorney Mike Waters recused himself, citing a conflict of interest. Waters had, in his capacity as a private criminal defense attorney before he was elected DA, represented a sheriff's deputy, Joshua Freeman, who was fired from the sheriff's department for misconduct following an investigation in which Coffey implicated Joshua Freeman in a DWI and cocaine possession. When Coffey was originally charged with obstructing justice, falsifying documents, and participating in a cocaine dealing conspiracy in Granville County, Waters personally asked Lauren Freeman, no relation to Joshua, to prosecute the case, and Freeman agreed. The motion from Coffey's lawyer suggests that the admitted conflict of interest on Waters' part should have prohibited him from further involving himself in the case. But after Freeman agreed to prosecute, she and Waters exchanged text messages that Coffey's lawyers, who obtained the message through a court order, say unduly influenced Freeman's handling of the case and that she now has a conflict of interest, too. The motion from attorneys Hart, Miles, Colin Cook, and Elliot Abrams from Raleigh's firm Cheshire Parker Schneider says, quote, specifically, Mr. Waters repeatedly suggested avenues for investigation through one-on-one text messages with Ms. Freeman. Furthermore, Waters remained copied on investigative reports in Coffey's case, and the motion states Waters, quote, instigated ill will toward Mr. Coffey through private text messages with Freeman. The texts aren't flattering. In one exchange, Waters sends Freeman a screenshot of a Facebook post from Coffey's wife, criticizing Freeman's prosecution of the case. Freeman responds by asking Waters to, quote, keep me sending stuff like this. 5 days later, Freeman charged Coffey with an additional 10 felonies per the motion. And it states, these charges were based almost entirely on uncorroborated statements of informants, statements that would likely fail to establish probable cause if utilized in support of a search warrant. Moreover, The allegations by these informants are seriously undermined by contemporaneous witness statements, police reports, and evidence submission reports, documents the prosecution team largely did not obtain until after bringing the charges. In another series of texts, Waters makes suggestions as how Freeman should proceed with the case, calling her a badass and writing that she could obtain training and standards records to help her make the case against Coffey. Freeman and her prosecution team did obtain these records, the motion states, and, quote, would then indict Coffey for 28 felonies, 14 of which were based on a theory never before utilized that, by putting allegedly false or misleading records into his boss's personnel folders at their insistence, Mr. Coffey committed the infamous felony offense of common law obstruction of justice, according to the motion. Freeman has drawn criticism in the past for not charging law enforcement officers who have assaulted or shot civilians, sometimes fatally, and for declining to bring charges against Raleigh detective Omar Abdullah, who framed more than a dozen men in a fake heroin scheme. Freeman did not respond to requests for comment from this story before the Indy went to print on Tuesday. Carissa Byrne Hessick, a professor at UNC Law School, says that Freeman's actions don't rise to the level of violating ethics rules that bind prosecutors by state statutes that could subject Freeman to any sort of professional discipline. Hessick says she also doesn't see how the texts are grounds for dismissal of the case, saying, I understand that Coffey's lawyers don't like the fact that Freeman was texting with Waters, that they don't want her to do that, but I have a hard time understanding how her having any sort of context with this DA has any bearing on her ability to prosecute the case. But Jim Coleman, a law professor at Duke University and director of the university's Center for Criminal Justice and Professional Responsibility, as well as its Wrongful Convictions Clinic, says he isn't surprised when he hears allegations of prosecutors behaving in ways that give an appearance of impropriety. Quote, prosecutors are supposed to be pursuing justice, not just to win. But when they are doing things that are inappropriate to advance their case, the conclusion from that is that they must be motivated more by winning than the pursuit of justice. The North Carolina bar that is supposed to monitor this kind of conduct is basically sitting on the sidelines when prosecutors openly engage in this kind of behavior. So the lesson that prosecutors take from that is that there are no consequences. A hearing in this case is scheduled for Tuesday in Wake County after the Indy's publishing deadline. This next story by Elizabeth Thompson was initially published by North Carolina Health News. Breaking point. Susan Rouse feels lucky that she hasn't gotten COVID-19 yet, but that's not the only thing she's worried about anymore. The 74-year-old from Wake County is incarcerated at Raleigh, North Carolina's Correctional Institution for Women, which, like many of North Carolina's prisons, experienced a surge in cases as the Omicron variant swept across the state in early January. North Carolina Health News previously reported on the toll the new variant could have on the state's prison system. Rouse was moved from the NCCIW's minimum security Canary unit to the prison's main campus shortly after Omicron surge began, and the Canary unit was closed due to staffing levels. More than 700 out of the prison system's roughly 13,000 staff members are currently not able to go to work after testing positive for COVID or being exposed to someone with the virus, according to North Carolina Department of Public Safety, DPS spokesman Brad Dean. Even though she's still considered an honor grade prisoner, many of the privileges that come with being housed in a minimum security facility, such as simple as being able to get a good night's sleep, have access to a microwave, or work outside the prison, are gone. As the latest Omicron surge has upended people's hopes that the pandemic was winding down and caused widespread frustration, the two-year anniversary of the pandemic's appearance in the United States means something different to incarcerated people. It has meant lockdowns, limiting their already sparse communication with the outside world. It's also meant fragmented or eliminated visits with family and friends. Each time a new surge has started, rules have changed. Now you can't touch your loved one. Now your visits are limited to 30 minutes. Now your visit is canceled. The pandemic has made life more unpredictable for everyone, but for prisoners, the lack of predictability has gone up yet another notch. And no matter how much some incarcerated people work toward gaining more privileges with good behavior, COVID outbreaks come and go, completely upending their status quo. NC Health News spoke to incarcerated people and their loved ones from across the state as the variant permeated the prison system. After 2 years of outbreak after outbreak, something is different this time. Some incarcerated people say they're reaching a breaking point. The numbers tell the tale. On January 20, the state prisons reported a high of 1,086 active cases, the most cases DPS has reported at least in the last 6 months. Three incarcerated people have died by suicide in the prisons since the beginning of 2022, according to press releases from DPS, just 1 month into the new year. According to DPS official releases, there were a total of 8 suicides in the prison system in 2021. As the Omicron variant began to surge in North Carolina prisons, the DPS took temporary actions to stop the spread on January the 12th. This included suspending work release programs and suspending visitation at some prisons. Much of NCCIW is now locked down, which means that incarcerated people spend almost all of their time in their dorms, Rouse said. Quote, the tension gets higher. There's nothing good about being enclosed in all but 1 hour a day. Another woman incarcerated at NCCIW who asked NC Health News to omit her name, she was afraid of retaliation from prison staff, said her anxiety was reaching fever pitch. Quote, none of the people are getting the mental health therapy they need. They're getting worse because they've not been able to visit or do anything. You're really doing hard time right now during COVID. Some prisons in the state have isolated people who have tested positive for COVID by placing them in cells typically used for solitary confinement, a practice which is considered psychological torture by the United Nations. Incarcerated people in North Carolina who were placed in solitary confinement were found to be 24% more likely to die in the first year after release, according to a study by researchers at UNC Chapel Hill. DPS spokesperson John Bull said in an email that incarcerated people who have tested positive for COVID and placed in these cells keep all their privileges as possible. They are not put there for punitive reasons, but for logistical reasons, Bull said. Dean said incarcerated people put in cells used for solitary confinement for, quote, health risk mitigation measures should have access to phone calls, recreation time, and mail, quote, unless pandemic safety reasons dictate otherwise, based on a prison's layout. Laura Garrett's boyfriend, who is incarcerated at Green Correctional Institution, spent Christmas in solitary. He spent a total of 17 days in a cell alone, and all the while he wasn't able to use the phone, she said. He didn't receive my mail while he was down there, Garrett said, and he thought I'd left him. I get letters where he talked about suicide. Many people outside of prison have experienced times of deprivation during each wave of COVID, but there is generally something to look forward to, said Eric Reinhardt, resident physician at Northwestern University Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. Quote, people in jails and prisons are enduring much more severe deprivations that corrode the basic conditions for life, for sanity, and they don't have much to look forward to. Maybe in 6 months they'll be allowed to go to a slightly bigger cell, but that's not really so sustaining. Jane, whose boyfriend is incarcerated at Johnston Correctional, asked to use a pseudonym for fear her boyfriend would face retaliation. Since the Omicron wave hit his prison, his dorm had been in quarantine. He was sick for more than 3 weeks, but said he was never tested for COVID. even though he is supposed to be released in a couple months. Jane's boyfriend told her he wasn't sure he was going to make it. She said, "He's like, will you still love me if I break?" And I said, "Of course." Incarcerated people are already more likely to have experienced trauma and suffer from mental illness than the general population. One study found that almost half of the incarcerated people in Iowa's Correctional Offender Network were diagnosed with a mental illness. Not to mention the fact that incarceration itself is traumatic, and it often re-traumatizes already traumatized people, exacerbating that past trauma. And that was before COVID. Now, inmates agree that the prison system is worse from the threat of getting sick with COVID, staffing shortages, and restrictions. Dean said mental health is a priority for prisons, quote, including what may be manifestations of these conditions, such as fighting and suicide. He said medical and custody staff are both trained to, quote, recognize and react to those conditions. As waves of COVID spread throughout the prison, fewer incarcerated people are leaving unscathed. Dean said, DPS, quote, will continue to follow the science and do what's possible to prevent COVID from getting into the facilities, to help prevent it from spreading to other facilities, and to confine it within a facility if it does get in. NC Health News previously reported on the confusion around testing at NCCIW during that Delta variant wave. It's likely many more people contracted COVID during that wave and the current Omicron surge than were reported, given such stories such as the one told by Jane's boyfriend, and it's likely many people re-entering society from prison will have long COVID, Reinhardt said. Quote, the way that COVID's going to affect them is not just through what the general population we're referring to as long COVID. It's going to affect them by synergistically interacting with chronic diseases from which incarcerated people suffer disproportionately, in part due to lack of access to good health care. Long COVID is not the only thing formerly incarcerated people might bring home with them, said Reinhardt. The trauma of being incarcerated during the pandemic will be coming home, too. Quote, the psychic weight of the pandemic is a lot heavier on people who live in conditions like we find in U.S. jails and prison, and there is also an aggregate effect over time. Well, now from Jasmine Gallup, news from, among other places, Chapel Hill, by hook or by crook. The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, which has faced mounting criticism over its treatment of black faculty and students, will soon go to the U.S. Supreme Court to defend its diversity-centric admission policies. Students for Fair Admission, a conservative group opposed to affirmative action, first sued UNC Chapel Hill in 2014. The group argued that UNC's admission policies, which consider the race of students, disadvantaged white and Asian American applicants. In October, a federal judge ruled in favor of the public university, writing, quote, it has a genuine and compelling interest in achieving the educational benefits of diversity and had demonstrated the benefits of its admission policies. The loss prompted Students for Fair Admission to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which agreed last week to take up the case, combining it with a similar lawsuit against Harvard University. UNC Chapel Hill spokeswoman Beth Keith said in a statement, we look forward to defending the university's holistic admissions process before the U.S. Supreme Court. As the trial court held, our process is consistent with long-standing Supreme Court precedent and allows for an evaluation of each student in a deliberate and thoughtful way. What is affirmative action? It's a loaded phrase at the best of time, dates back to the Reconstruction era, says William Spriggs, professor of economics at Howard University in Washington. Quote, most schools in the North openly sought black students. They were the most outspoken against slavery. Spriggs says, starting around the end of the 1870s and through the early 1920s, you will see this swelling of black graduates from all the elite schools. Within 50 years, however, the country's attitude changed. As elite private universities opened their door to public school students instead of just prep school students, they also created admission policies specifically designed to keep certain people out. The rise of eugenics and scientific racism in the 1920s led universities to discriminate against black students, Jewish students, and other minorities, said Spriggs. Quote, "You had these eugenicists who were convinced they could document racial inferiority. Standardized testing was implemented initially to document inferiority. The tests were scaled and designed so colleges could recruit the right people out of the public schools. The elite schools did not want to offend Southerners, and black students disappeared." Affirmative action, as we know it today, emerged during the civil rights movements of the 1960s as businesses and schools faced pressure from the federal government to integrate. An executive order from President John F. Kennedy established the concept of taking affirmative action to recruit people of color to schools and jobs. Spriggs says, "The horrors of the Holocaust and the Nazi movement made the eugenics movement try their best to disappear. By the end of the 1950s, because of Dr. King and the Montgomery bus boycott and the victory Howard Law School had ending public segregation, many of the elite schools felt like, well, we can't keep all blacks out." In 1964, the Civil Rights Act was passed, prohibiting employment discrimination. Later, in 1969, the Nixon administration successfully implemented the Philadelphia Plan, which required government contractors in the state to hire minority workers and set goals and timetables for diversifying their workforce. Some states, businesses, and universities followed suit, but not without facing penalty of backlash. Almost as soon as colleges began considering race in admissions, white men and women who were denied entrance began suing on the basis of reverse discrimination. In 1978, the Supreme Court decided a case that set the precedent for affirmative action for decades. Alan Bakke, who is white, sued the University of California Medical School after he was twice denied admission. The court's decision in Regents of the University of California versus Bakke was mixed. Although it outlawed racial quotas, the system used by the University of California, it ruled that other, more narrow considerations of race were lawful. That position was held in Grutter versus Bollinger, 2003, when the court ruled that race could be considered as one of several factors in an admissions decision. Despite the Supreme Court rulings, black students remain massively underrepresented in colleges and universities across the country. Today, many arguments against affirmative action revert to a 1920s ideology, says Spriggs. Quote, "Most of the arguments now still rest on a belief that the presence of black students mean you have admitted inferior students. They clearly presume it's not possible that black students are equal. Their argument is, you must have put your thumb on the scale in order to get this result." At UNC Chapel Hill, black students currently make up 8.7% of the total student population. Most students come from Wake County, where the population of black high school graduates is more than triple that number at about 31.7%. Many other students come from Mecklenburg County, where about 41% of graduates are black, and Guilford County, where 37.8% are black. The history of segregation at UNC Chapel Hill has left a lasting mark on the student body. The first black students were accepted to the university in 1951, when a court order forced the law school to admit them. The school's population of black students grew until the 1980s, when it plateaued at around 7 or 8%. Growth of the black student body resumed in 1994, peaking a decade later at 10%. Since the 2003-04 academic year, however, black enrollment has dropped. Jarrah Fay, president of the university's NAACP, says the challenge of the UNC's affirmative action policies is troublesome. It just lets me know that even the mere thought of black and brown students having a chance to be a part of the higher education bothers people. At what point do we take a stand and say, this is a direct challenge to black students? Students who are probably first generation, who don't come from traditional backgrounds, but are trying to get an education, to get a chance to be something. Faye says she appreciates the UNC's defense of its admission policies, but it feels performative. Quote, here you are trying to support an increased diversity in your student population, but once you get that diversity, you're not doing anything to ensure that population is protected. You're not doing anything to make them feel safe. The same way they're fighting for this policy in the Supreme Court, UNC Chapel Hill should fight for policies that support diversity within the school system. What can we expect next? The Supreme Court will likely hear the case during its next term, which starts this October. The court currently has a solid conservative majority, which is unlikely to change even if President Joe Biden appoints another liberal justice following Stephen Breyer's retirement. Spriggs is not optimistic about the outcome of the case, he says. The fact that the courts want to treat this as an ahistorical phenomenon, that isn't what went on, he says. It's like we're going to, by hook or by crook, find our way back to 1950, whatever it takes, and that would be really unfortunate. Now, as a sidebar to that article, there is where the U.S. Supreme Court justices likely stand on affirmative action, and it includes a prediction, 6-3 decision against affirmative action, and they list the judges and what they assume their stance will probably be. They don't include Stephen Breyer's retirement as a category there. All right, let's get on to our feature article. The column's written by Brian Howe, a music critic there at Indie Week, and it's called Majesty's Secret Service, the extraordinary story of tragedy and resilience behind a rising Raleigh musician's apocalyptic reggae pop. Last summer, the musician and entrepreneur Majesty dropped a new single, Last Trumpet, which blends reggae and R&B into a gentle warning of the end of the world. Released via his music company, Dan Fashion Entertainment, the song is nearing 36,000 Spotify plays, where it's his second most popular song after the equally lilting and premonitory Babylon Burn. Both singles, along with several others he has made since 2019, will be on his first album, slated for September 30th. Then, last fall, he put the debut line from his new clothing company on sale. TriFit USA focuses especially, but not exclusively, on large sizes. The sweatshirts and pants sport clean black and white designs and proclaim messages like faith over fear and kupatikana tayari, which means be found ready in Swahili. The one-man company has global aims with warehouse space in Europe as well as closer to home in Raleigh. Mid-2022 should bring his first shoe line. Intended to be luxurious yet affordable, the sneakers are partly inspired their designer's memories of being teased for his size 18 shacks as a kid. At age 28, he stands 6 feet 6 inches tall, weighs 235 pounds, and looks every bit the former athlete and personal trainer that he is. On first impression, you might peg him as someone who has breezed through life on a tailwind of luck, popularity, and existential confidence, but with Majesty, whose soft-spoken, hypnotically steady eloquence reveals a highly introspective nature, things are always more than they appear. Take TriFit USA. Its slogan, a brand with a message, and its logo, a cross, make it seem like a Christian company. But after seeking his way through several organized religions, Majesty jettisoned them all, entering into a more direct personal rapport with God that imbued his music and fashion with a new sense of purpose. His message is the bittersweet yield of a promising life story turned off course again and again by physical injuries, mental health crises, medical misdiagnoses, drug abuse, and baroque misfortune, before it reached the unsuspected destination at the crossroads of worldly work and otherworldly faith. It's a story that revivifies stock clichés about what it means for an artist to have a voice, to have dreams. It all happens something like this. Majesty was born in Nathaniel Jerry Dan Salama Peterkin Adon. A Christian minister visiting Pinehurst had told his mother, also a minister, that she would have a special son who would do great things, and he would be called New Son of Peace, Dan, D-A-N. In a mix of Arabic and Nigerian languages, his full name means God's gift, God wins, New Son of Peace, Rock of Stone, Lord. In a long conversation conducted by video chat, phone, and email over several weeks, he says, "Later I was like, I can't be out here saying all these names as an artist, but I could break them down to Majesty, that's M-A-J, the numeral 3, S-T-Y. I put the 3 in just because of stuff I grew up with about the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, even though my beliefs differ. During his school years in Charlotte, Rockingham, and Southern Pines, he was a big nerd with glasses, getting picked on a lot, who hid in Harry Potter books and feared speaking out. He was tall long before he was big and strong. His parents urged him into confidence-building school activities like basketball, which led him to join his high school team, and congressional speech and debate, which carried him off to rhetorical competition at distant universities like Harvard and George Mason. He says, it was like one of these classic high school movies where the jock falls in love with stuff that's not jock-like. I started excelling more at speech and debate than I ever did in basketball. Anyway, his secret wish had always been to play football. He even furtively made his middle school team, he says, but hasn't asked his parents for permission and didn't get it. But then one day in his senior year, the football coach chased him down in the schoolyard. "Hey, big guy, let me talk to you. Man, you got some good size. How old are you?" Learning of the parental ban on football, the coach said he'd call them. Majesty had doubts, but when he got home, they said yes. Unfortunately, his patellar tendon said no. He tore it in a basketball scrimmage and missed the whole year of football. Still, he'd practiced enough to be invited to observe practices at NC Central University. He enrolled there at 2011 and excelled academically as a freshman, but never got around to football. By the next school year, he was gone. At NC Central, where he rapped under names like Lyric and Chief Ali, he also started partying a lot, as newly loosed young folks will do, and got mixed up with the wrong crowd. A big wave of angel dust had come through the area, and the stuff in my circles was laced. I thought I was smoking straight ganja. This was the start of a downward spiral that lasted for 4 years. After flunking out in 2013, he dealt weed until he lost his apartment in 2014. He lived in his car for more than 8 months, still using drugs until one fateful day in 2015. Majesty isn't sure exactly why the police approached him. "I think," he says, "it probably has to do with a large African-American male wandering around in the summertime with a big coat on and an aggressive-looking dog, and I think the area of Chapel Hill I was in was predominantly Caucasian. But the interaction wasn't aggressive on either side." The officers asked him if he was okay. He said he was not, and they took him to the UNC hospital. There, he says, he signed forms he didn't understand and was moved to the psychiatric ward. He couldn't remember his parents' phone number for several days, and later, he wasn't allowed to check himself out. He was hospitalized for almost a month before his mother came and took him to Pinehurst with a new diagnosis of schizophrenia and a raft of prescriptions. He found he couldn't hold down a job. Counting parts in a machine shop, he'd fall asleep on his feet. He gained enough weight to have hypertension and arthritis, but he still carried the belief that he had to play football for his family's sake, and he started forcing himself to train through his depression. "I didn't want to be who they said I was," he says, meaning everyone who thought he was weak or sick or a failure, everyone who'd wronged him or whom he'd wronged. Over time, something clicked, and the music became a part of it. He worked out early in the morning before his family awoke, listening to Bob Marley, quote, to mellow out the sadness of the whole experience. He couldn't have guessed that in just a few years he would be opening for Julian Marley in South Carolina. He returned to Durham in 2017, newly muscled and running a 4.2 on the 40-yard dash. "I was solid," he says. "I was good." He re-enrolled at Central in 2018 and graduated with an English degree in 2020, which he has used to teach in public schools. But once again, football was not to be. He says he got clearance to play from the NCAA, but a paperwork mishap slammed his chance shut. Determined, he decided to go out for a developmental league. First, he needed a checkup. He'd been having seizures and blackouts after a change in his medication, but he discovered that his doctor, who'd made the change, had left without notice. He remembers, "There's this new guy sitting there. He looked at me, typed in his computer, looked at me again, and said, 'I can tell you right now, you don't have schizophrenia.' He said I needed to go off the medications immediately." This was both validating and frightening. He had long felt that something in his treatment was not right. "I had doubted the diagnosis, but then I started to believe it, I guess just because of my childhood. I was abused a lot. I was molested by two women as a teen, but I started getting suspicious when I was having the seizures because I'd never had them before. I was holding back tears, like, maybe he's tripping, but what if he's telling the truth?" Soon his schizophrenia diagnosis was replaced by a new one, post-traumatic stress disorder, dating back to his childhood. Off his meds, he started feeling better. For a while, stressful situations or flashing lights could still trigger seizures, but they receded with time and self-care. He hasn't had one in a year now. He says, in the tone of voice that someone conclusively shutting a book, "I had to eat that loss of 4 years of my life and have to forgive those people and let it go. If I allow that to make me angry every day, I don't get my life back and they win." "I'm going to have to eat this," Majesty thought one day in 2018 as he floored his failing brakes, they were later recalled, and his Ford sedan plowed into the back of a stopped Chevy work van. His hood crumpled and his head cracked a star in his windshield. Dazed, he got out of the car, crawled into the back seat, and drank from a gallon of water. He stumbled across Durham's Martin Luther King Jr. Parkway to check on the other driver, who was also banged up but intact. But when the ambulances and police cars arrived in a blur of flashing lights, Majesty's knees buckled. It was a week after he'd gone off his med, and 1 week before he'd step onto a Raleigh field in 100-degree weather for the semi-pro football tryouts. He says, about halfway in, "I understand I was probably not going to be able to play football. My feet feel like quicksand. My head is spinning. Everything's going up and down, like it's on a seesaw." Still, he finished the day. When football was gone, music remained. "At first, my parents were kind of half in, half out of the music thing," he says. "They said I still needed a plan B. I was like, I keep having plan Bs, and life doesn't work out for me. This time I want to go with a plan A." Plan A revealed its promise when Babylon Berne caught on in Nigeria through radio play in 2019. "O Jah Shaddai, the time's near. O God showed me the time's near. O Lord, the fire's here," Majesty sings. Last Trumpet has the same tenderly apocalyptic flavor. "There will be a time on this earth that you've never seen before. I do this for the ones that I love and all that I adore." He says, I was hesitant about putting out Babylon Burn because I didn't understand the words I was writing and how biblically sound it was until my family started relating to me. It was a little eerie. He recorded the song in a darkened studio, watching the beat ripple in the air like a wave. Seeing music as shapes and colors is called synesthesia. Majesty often hears in red and green. A purple aura would presage his seizures. These experiences seem like surface manifestation of the numinous perception that stands in such distinct contrast to Majesty's calm, lucid presence. He's one of those rare liminal people who are uniquely attuned to the thin places between this world and others. He's been told that when he was very young, riding through the country in a car, he would tap on the window and say, "I see slaves in the field." His songs come from the powerful dreams he's always had. Steeped in his ancestral heritage, Jamaican, Bantu, Native American, these dreams whisper obscure yet insistent prophecies in a voice he feels is not his own. He tried to drown it out in his hedonistic days, but when the medication quieted it, he missed it. A part of him felt missing, he says. I don't want to say that dreams got worse around the time of my breakdown, because the dreams aren't bad. They made me, me. But they got more intense. That's what led them to believe I was schizophrenic. When I got up, my mom asked me what the voice was telling me. It was always something positive, but I knew it was outside of me, so I questioned it. It scared me and made me think I was crazy. She said, "No, son, that's the voice of God." Who or what was God, though? He hadn't found the answer in Christianity or Islam or Rastafarianism, which he dove into in 2016 and then gave up, along with marijuana, in 2018, the year he took the Nazirite vow of godly devotion, purity, and abstention. He started singing more than rapping and purged sex, violence, and materialism from his music. In 2020, he renounced religious labels altogether, as if the external codes of conduct became vestigial once he hewed them into an internal code, all his own. He says, "It doesn't mean I'm frowning on religion. I was reaffirming that I've done enough self-exploration, trying to belong to something, and I come to the conclusion that I don't belong to anything except God. I know my music is meant to be on a bigger platform than I may be comfortable with or feel worthy of. I'm not doing it because of a belief I have. I'm doing it because of something I believe the Most High is telling me, and this scares me to my core." Majesty's music and fashion are a direct conduit from his dreams to the wider world, amplifying the secret signals of his divine charge. He sums up, "Walk in righteousness and purpose, wear righteousness, but give yourself grace when you fail. At the end of your life on earth, that should put you in good standing, so that you are found ready, even if you call it the universe and not God. I've been given more than one chance to understand that life can be short, and you have to be righteous urgently." For a message that made him question his sanity, it sounds patently sane. Whether or not we believe in the afterlife, our deeds will outlast us. Whether or not we believe in a final arbiter, our peers and the future will judge us. And whether or not we believe in the rapture these days, we all might recognize the growing intuition that time is running out. Kupatikana Tayari. Well, now, Gopi Mendick, food columnist at the Indie Week, writes about a woman, Shariwiwe. As a teenager, Shariwiwe hated when her parents, Zari and Leon Wei, dragged her to their farm to help weed, hoe, and harvest produce. A decade later, fresh out of college, Wei, who goes by Riri, still dislikes the heat and the physical labor of field work. Some days when I'm not working, my mom will force me to go, but I still go with an attitude, she laughs. But as much as she dreads picking green beans, Riri is excited to be the incoming executive director of Transplanting Traditions Community Farm, the same place where her parents started growing on a small plot of land over 10 years ago, where they still farm today for a CSA with over 50 members. Riri was 8 when her family moved to the United States from Tham Hinh, a refugee camp in Thailand where she was born. The civil war in Burma, the English name of Burma, was officially changed to Myanmar by its ruling government in 1989, had been going on for decades, where periods of internal conflict and violence continue to this day. Between 2008 and 2014, over 100,000 refugees from Burma were resettled across the United States. Many, like Riri, came from refugee camps on the border of Burma and Thailand. Tham Hinh is one of the most closed-off camps, being off the electricity grid and accepting few visitors. For those reasons, Riri explains that when tourists occasionally visited, or in one instance when a helicopter arrived carrying individuals from outside of Burma, she thought they were from another planet. "I always thought that we were the only people that existed in the world," she says. In 2006, Riri's family initially resettled in South Carolina, where they struggled with the lack of community and little support. A distant relative living in the Triangle encouraged them to come to Carrboro, where they moved 6 months later. The family found a community of Karen refugees, whom they had known in Tham Hinh, and Riri's father got a job with UNC Housekeeping. Soon thereafter, Zari and Lion Wei started farming at a new farm called Transplanting Traditions. And in 2013, Riri was one of the first teens to pilot the youth program at the organization. Over the years, she has remained involved in various capacities, interning, translating, and consulting on projects, and has witnessed the expansion of the organization and the growth of the individuals involved. Transplanting Traditions Community Farm founder Kelly Owensby first met Burmese refugee families while working at a community garden project managed by the Orange County Partnership for Young Children. She says, "I learned that so many folks from Burma held an incredibly rich agricultural heritage and multi-generational knowledge of farming and living with the land. Upon resettlement, one of the first impulses for a people once deeply rooted in farming was that part of the process of recreating home was to get their hands in the soil and seeds," Owensby explains. When the opportunity arose to expand the garden, she applied for a grant from the Office of Refugee Resettlement and received 3 years of funding to start Transplanting Traditions. In 2010, its first year, 44 individuals from Burma worked collectively, she says, to turn a pasture into a farm. The organization's mission, according to its website, is to uplift food sovereignty in the refugee community through access to land, education, and opportunities for refugee farmers to address community food insecurity and the barriers they face in reaching their dreams of farming. It's become a hub for individuals of the Karen and Chin ethnic groups in the Triangle, and currently 22 individuals farm over 100 varieties of produce at Transplanting Traditions. While some members farm on just a few beds for themselves and their family and friends, others sell at the Carrboro Farmers Market and Chapel Hill Farmers Market, or provide produce to local businesses and restaurants like Snap Pea Catering and Rose's Noodles, Dumplings, and Sweets. Owensby, the acting executive director of Transplanting Traditions, has roots in Western North Carolina and will be transitioning out of her role this spring as she trains Riri. Riri, who is 23, initially doubted herself when offered the job. "I was fresh out of college, so I had a lot of negative self-talk," says Reby, who graduated from Guilford College in 2021, where she majored in community and justice studies, forced migration, and resettlement studies. It took me a lot of convincing and a little bit of self-love. She's also confident in the skills that have been passed down to her. She says, any skills you've learned and gained, these things are replicable. Share this knowledge with other people. If someone has no education background, no high school degree, teach them. There are hard skills and soft skills that can both be learned and taught, so share with other people. This sentiment applies to transplanting traditions programming, which provides workshops and professional development training to farmers of all skill levels. And in addition to Owensby's support, Riri is supported by the familiar environment of the farming community at Transplanting Traditions. I call them aunt, uncle, grandma, and grandpa, she says. I feel very supported going into this role and that I'm going into this as a community and with my family together. A 2015 survey found that only 8% of nonprofit executive directors were people of color. Though this gap exists in other sectors, it is especially jarring when it comes to nonprofits, the majority of which have social welfare and justice-centered missions. I asked Riri why she believes this dissonance still exists. It definitely has a lot to do with, are we willing to give up our power? She says, a lot of organizations I've been with are all about the talk, but then they don't implement it and do the action, and I see why those things have been hurtful to the community. In part, this is why Owensby is taking a back seat at Transplanting Traditions. Quote, I'm a white woman leading a community-based organization in which I do not share culture, language, needs, and experiences. No matter how hard I tried, I experienced over and over the ways in which I was limited. My hands were tied in my ability to lead authentically. For many of the farmers at Transplanting Traditions, the biggest benefit of a Karen executive director is basic communication. Being able to have someone in leadership who can speak my language is really beneficial and helpful, says Sirsir Thart, a farmer at Transplanting. If I have anything I want to ask or share, I can go directly to this person instead of having to wait for an interpreter who will have to communicate with that person and then come back to me, and it takes much longer. Sirsir Thart fled her village in Burma at the age of 15. For several years, she moved from village to village, continually being forced out when the military would arrive. She ended up at Tom Hin refugee camp in her 30s. Before resettling, she was a farmer in Burma. Now, in North Carolina, she misses growing rice and other tropical produce that's difficult to farm in a North Carolina climate. Still, she's grateful for the access to land and her 10 years of farming at Transplanting Traditions. She says, I'm able to have a supplemental income, grow and eat my own food that's chemical-free, and I'm able to save and store them throughout the year, especially wintertime. Initially, she just grew food for her family, but she since joined a share-a-share program. Here, individuals' donations are used to purchase Southeast Asian produce grown by Transplanting Traditions farmers, such as Sirsir Thart, a produce that is then donated to Porch, a Chapel Hill, Carrboro-based organization that aims to alleviate hunger and promote better nutrition in the community. Porch distributes the produce to local refugee families who have limited access to healthy foods. The 8 acres of farmland also create an opportunity to grow varieties of produce that were common in Burma but not widely available in the United States. Some of these ingredients are sold at Asian grocery stores, but the produce is usually imported and is not pesticide-free. Sirsir Thart lists some of her favorite crops to both grow and eat. Roselle, Thai chili, Asian cucumber, and Thai pumpkin. You can eat the shoots and the fruit. Riri seconds her love of roselle, also known as hibiscus, because of its unique sweet and sour flavor. A favorite Burmese recipe using the ingredients is roselle paste with chili. The Roselle leaves, rather than the more pink flowers of the plant, are cooked down in water until the mixture becomes a paste. Once the Roselle breaks down, the cook adds a little bit of onion, shrimp paste, salt, and chili to their own taste. The sweet, spicy, sour paste is delicious, served with rice, and can be stored in the fridge for several weeks. There are no Karen restaurants in the area, so having the fresh ingredients available allows Sir Sir Tart, Riri, and so many others to cook and enjoy Burmese dishes at home here in North Carolina. The challenges and hardships that refugees face do not, of course, come to a halt after being resettled in a new community. Transplanting Traditions Community Farm provides opportunities and support for many refugee families, but also a space to find community and to sustain, nurture, and celebrate their culture here in North Carolina. Riri concludes, "Deciding to come home and reconnect with my elders wasn't in my mind to do this early in my life, but it's really been a blessing." Now, there's just not even time to read the op-ed column by Natalie Murdoch this week. I can just summarize it a little bit about the 2020 census, which says it tells us a lot about North Carolina, where we've been, where we are, and trends that show us where we're going. We gained nearly 1 million new residents in the past decade. If you were to gauge the changing demographics over the past decade based on Republican congressional legislative maps, you'd think that our state had grown sufficiently whiter, older, and more rural since 2010. If this were truly the case, it would be understandable that North Carolinians would move from having 8 Republicans and 5 Democrats in Congress to 11 Republicans and 3 Democrats under new maps. This kind of drastic swing doesn't add up when you look at North Carolina's demographics. And she concludes, as North Carolina becomes progressive, more urban, and more diverse, Republicans are sticking their heads in the sand. Their maps whitewash North Carolina's future. The Republican-drawn maps reflect the North Carolina that the GOP wants to see, not as it truly is. Republicans want to gerrymander away our state's growth and identity. We can't let them do that. And John Fetterson, now I have to close this, get ready for my limbo contest. I hope they've set the bar pretty high. We will be here in another week. You can hear this broadcast at the podcast section at ncreadingservice.org. That's our website. I hope that you'll stay tuned and come back and hear another Indie Week from the North Carolina Reading Service. So long.